In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Okay, good evening, welcome. Class number 9 or 10, something like that. 10. So tonight we're at bottom of page 74, which is getting closer to the way to actually meditate. Closer and closer. Let's see what he's got to say tonight. So, the way those meditations generate the view. I stated there are two types of self-entity to be negated. They are negated in order to reverse our fixation on and belief in the entities of percepts and perceivers as objectively real things. However, if ultimately we grasp at the entities of percepts and perceivers as empty, or cling to them as non-existent, that too is not right. Nagarjuna says in his fundamental treatise, the victors teach emptiness as what brings definite release from all views. Those for whom emptiness is a view are said to be unable to accomplish anything. The discourse for Kashyapa. Somehow I think we did this. Does anyone have that feeling? We did. So where are we? We're
on page 76.
Okay. Yeah. The fundamental treatise on the middle way teaches.
We got through
page. I don't have page numbers like this.
Chris, can you hold on for a second? Debbie.
Yeah, we in the book, we finished through the bottom of page 75.
Oh, right. Okay. The fundamental treatise, as Chris was saying, states, there is no existent phenomena that is not dependently originated. There is, therefore, no existent phenomena that is not empty. Similar to what we talked about last week. Empty phenomena appear, and all phenomena are empty. Only that which is empty appears, and only that which appears is empty. All of that which appears is empty. And do not say, it is empty. Do not proclaim, it is not empty. Also do not say that it's both or not both. Such expressions should only be used as conventional designations. Don't make absolutist statements. It also states, to say something exists is to hold it to be permanent. To say it does not exist is to view it nihilistically. Thus, the wise do not abide in either existence or non-existence. The auto-commentary on the Two Truths by Jnanagarbha explains, therefore, the Bhagavan said, things are not empty, not non-empty, not existent and non-existent, not non-arising and do not arise. It's getting pretty slippery, like you can't say anything around here. You're just going to get like shot down, whatever it is you say. Therefore, okay, so people are accustomed to engaging with their various mental constructs and are frightened by the non-existence of bases that provide their minds with grounds with which to engage. Imagine if everything around us was empty and there was like nowhere to settle that could be identified as real. Wouldn't that be scary? and are frightened by the non-existence of bases that provide their minds with grounds with which to engage. Our mind engages with grounds. That's all our mind does. Such as perceived characteristics or reference points of some sort. By taking comfort in sources of perceived characteristics and so forth, they cling to existence or non-existence, emptiness, non-emptiness, and so forth, and bring ruin. Ruins. Or runes to the world. The precious garland, Nagarjuna says in the precious garland. It's a little odd to say the text observes. Shouldn't it be like the person says in that text? But people who are afraid of this baseless Dharma take comfort in bases. So even the Dharma is baseless. Since they cling to existence and non-existence, the wise are ruined. The unwise are ruined. We may now ask, since the entities that are percepts and perceivers do not exist at all as entities, non-entities, or anything else, is this the Chittamatra's view of reflexive awareness, reflexive clarity? So are we saying that there's nothing but mind, nothing but the reflexive quality of knowing? And it would have to be reflexive because there's nothing to know other than mind. So therefore, the mind is knowing itself. No, it is not. Although that reflexive awareness may occur during some meditative experiences generated by certain circumstances, actually, it does not exist. So the first step is that phenomena do not exist. The self, or the true existence of self and phenomena, is unfounded. And now we turn the critical eye back on our own perceiver and look at, is our mind existent? The Buddha, in the Descent into Lanka Sutra, explains, external entities are neither existent nor non-existent. Mind is ungraspable. All views are relinquished. By virtue of understanding that, we let go of views of any kind. You can't hold any opinion. You can't hold any conceptual construct about the way things are. That is the characteristic of non-arising. That we can't say that anything actually arises. Nagarjuna, in his entrance to the Bodhisattva's way of life, that would be Shanti Davis, says, if cognition is never seen by anyone, it is pointless to speculate about whether it is illuminating or not. And he's talking about, there's a big argument in the Mahayana tradition about reflexive awareness, whether it exists or not. And some traditions say that's the way that we know everything, is because we have a sort of mechanical experience of our sense perceptions, and then we know those sense perceptions with the reflexive quality of mind. And then others say, well, that would go on ad infinitum. You would have to have a knower to know the knower, and so forth, if that were true. So there's these two points of view about the possibility of reflexive awareness. If cognition is never seen by anybody, which is an interesting statement, no one has ever seen the mind, which is sort of undermines our whole attempt to meditate on the nature of the mind, doesn't it? So we should remember that when we get back to that. It's pointless to speculate about whether mind is illuminating, whether it self-illuminates or not, illuminates itself or not, just as it would be to speculate about the beauty of a barren woman's child. Shantideva also says in that text, once neither entities nor non-entities remain before the mind, since there is no other form, then there is peace, free from reference point. That's how peace is defined in the Buddhist tradition, freedom from reference point. Not being attached or clinging or disturbed by the conceptual recognition of any characteristics. A summary of those points is found in Kamala Shila's first Bhavanakrama Stages of Meditation. Thus it is that you should consider these three realms are only mind. These three realms are only mind. All there is mind. So the three realms, desire, form, and formless realms, are only mind. There's no real existent phenomena. So all there is perception of appearances. Therefore, all imagined phenomena are understood to be simply mind. Mind looking at itself, manifesting as if they were external phenomena. If you discern that, if you understand that, you discern the nature of all phenomena, that they are not separate from mind. So this is a big leap. Many of us are fine with Madhyamaka reasoning of non-existent, of truly existent phenomena, absence rather of truly existent phenomena. But then that to say that everything is mind is a big leap. And the logic is that if there are no truly existent phenomena, and yet we still have perception, then all we can say is there's perception from some point of view. We're about to undermine that, I have a feeling as well. But if you discern that, you discern the nature of all phenomena, and thus you discern the essential nature of the mind. Analyze that mind as follows. Mind cannot possibly be real in an ultimate sense. That's a little bit odd. That sounds like a conclusion rather than like a analysis, which would, it seems to me, would be more like a question, but he's jumping to the conclusion maybe. How can the mind that apprehends forms and so forth, things which are of a false nature? So if we're seeing things that aren't there, then is that mind really there? How can the mind that apprehends forms and so forth, things which are of a false nature, and that itself appears as various images, be real? So how can that mind itself be real? Just as forms and so forth are false, so too is the mind false, since it does not exist apart from those forms and so forth. Just as forms and so forth are neither of the nature of a single unit nor of the nature of a plurality, since they have various manifestations, mind is neither of the nature of a single unit nor of the nature of a plurality, since it does not exist apart from those forms and so forth. And he's invoking the fundamental principle of consciousness or mind in the Buddhist tradition is that mind arises in response or in relationship to an object. And you can't have mind without an object. So he says, mind is neither of the nature of a single unit nor of the nature of a plurality, since mind does not exist apart from those forms and so forth. We only see mind or know mind by what mind experiences. That being so, mind simply seems to be of the nature of illusions. This, and so forth is a reference to there's a series of analogies or similes for the illusory quality of phenomena, including the mind, in many of the Prajnaparamita sutras and other sutras. And there's a series of 8 and some there's 10 and some 12. And so when he says illusions and so forth, He's saying it's like illusions, a dewdrop, and so on and so forth, a mirage. And just like the mind, all phenomena simply seem to be of the nature of illusions, and so forth. Thus, you analyze. So, although he states it in the form of conclusions, for him this is a way of analyzing. It's a little bit odd. I don't know, maybe if it might be possible to translate it more as like a question, but I'm not sure. Therefore, when you discern the nature of mind with prajna, ultimately you neither observe the mind to be internal, nor do you observe it to be external. You do not observe it to be neither of those two. You do not observe a past mind, a future mind, and not even a present mind. You can't observe the mind of the past, you can't observe the mind of the future, because one is gone and the other hasn't happened, and the mind of the present is ungraspable. Therefore, when you when the mind arises, it does not come from anywhere. When it ceases, it does not go anywhere. The mind is not graspable. It cannot be shown, and it does not have form. Now, we knew that about the mind, that it doesn't have form. That's like Buddhist Abhidharma 101, right? There's form and there's mind. But what is the nature of that which cannot be shown, cannot be grasped, and is not physical? The Buddha, in the Discourse for Kashyapa, which is a sutra in a collection called the Heap of Jewels, comments, Kashyapa, when you look for mind, it is not found. What cannot be found cannot be observed. What cannot be observed is neither past, future, nor present. This way of determining that phenomena are mind and recognizing experientially that mind is space-like dharmata beyond identification is far superior to the common ways of meditating on an analytical emptiness or an intellectually fabricated emptiness. So what he's saying here is that one possibility is to use the logical reasonings of the Madhyamaka tradition, that things are neither one nor many, that phenomena are beyond cause and result, because causation and being a result have no logical coherence when we analyze them individually. And instead, by seeing the unfindability of something that's so close to us, that's the closest thing possible, is the best way to meditate. So without explaining it very clearly, he's actually pointing out how to meditate on the nature of the mind, the nature of reality, how to meditate with Vipassana. And that way to meditate is to understand first intellectually, through logical reasoning, the unfindability of phenomena, of percepts, and then the perceiver, the mind, and then to get familiar with that experience of not being able to find, which is a state of mind that can't rest anywhere, that doesn't settle anywhere, that doesn't have a conclusion, that doesn't come to the conclusion that something is or isn't, but that remains suspended, as if in suspended animation, in suspense. The mind is present, our awareness is present vividly and stably and with strength, the various qualities of shamatha, as the support for looking, for insight, for analysis. And we analyze what we can't find. We look for what we can't find. And so we become accustomed to letting go of being able to conclude anything about anything one way or another, and just remain vividly present and aware and open, most importantly, open, not like, not shifting into a conclusion. Oh, that's how it is. As soon as you say that's how it is, you've missed the point. The point is to be able to remain without concluding anything. It accords with the following explanations. Maitreya's Ornament for Mahayana Sutras says, aware that there is nothing other than mind, they then recognize that mind also does not exist. Those intelligent ones are aware that both are non-existent and abide in the Dharma Dhatu, devoid in the, of those. And so this presentation of two stages or steps in the practice of Vipassana meditation in this tradition as presented here, in this presentation of the common Sutrayana or Mahayana tradition of Vipassana, is a series of steps that starts with understanding the non-findability of percepts, phenomena, and then understanding the non-findability of the perceiver, the mind. And this gets codified, so to speak, by Atisha in his slogans, in his Absolute Bodhicitta meditation slogans, where he says, all dharmas are dreams. Regard all dharmas as dreams. So see all phenomena as illusion-like. Regard them as illusion-like. And then analyze the nature of unborn awareness. Awareness has never come about. It's unfindable. And this then gets placed in the context of what's called the fourfold pointing out of the Mahamudra tradition, which starts with regard all dharmas as mind is the first step. By virtue of not being able to find anything that exists separate from our mind, we understand that all dharmas are mind. And then the second stage is mind itself is empty. Now the Mahamudra tradition goes a couple of steps further or slightly beyond what is presented here and says emptiness is spontaneously present. And then spontaneous presence is self-liberated, which is slightly different than Atisha's slogans. Atisha's third slogan is self-liberate even the antidote, which like has a quality of letting go, whereas the Mahamudra one, emptiness is spontaneous present is spontaneously present, has a quality of sort of affirming almost experience. And then the fourth one in the Mahamudra tradition, spontaneous presence is self-liberated, is another letting go. Vasubandhu, his commentary on Maitreya's Ornament for Mahayana Sutras says, in that text, he says, it says, he's referring to Maitreya's text, there is no object observed that is other than mind. The only thing we can ever experience is our mind. All phenomena are perceived by our sense faculties, and that's all we ever perceive is the consciousness of our sense faculties. By recognizing that, bodhisattvas comprehend deeply that mere mind, the word mere is a heavily significant word. It means not truly existent. Mind is also not existent, since there is no perceiving subject if there is no perceived object. Again, invoking that time-worn rule of Buddhist Abhidharma that mind only exists with an object. Aware that those two do not exist. Bodhisattvas abide in the Dharma Dhatu, which has neither of those and is free from the characteristics of percepts and perceivers. In that way, bodhisattvas directly realize the Dharma Dhatu. The Dharma Dhatu is the realm of Dharma, the realm of ultimate nature of reality. That brings us to the specific explanation of the ways to meditate on that view, which has three parts, starting with identifying the correct view. As explained above, intellectually meditating upon anything, entities, non-entities, both of those, neither of those, and so forth, causes us to cling to the extremes of permanence or nihilism. Even meditating on emptiness, non-arising, the absence of reference points, and the like, is in an intellectual way, involves a conceived object or misdirected arrogance, an arrogance that presumes that we can meditate on it, on something. How dare you? How could you? How could you be so presumptuous? None of those are the way to meditate on the actual view. So, the first part explained above, intellectually meditating upon anything, causes us to cling to the extremes of permanence or nihilism. So now we're not supposed to meditate on anything. Earlier it was like, it was helpful the difference is meditate. Outside of meditation, we analyze. We go through the stages of prajna, study, contemplate. We have to know our dharmas. We have to understand how dharmas exist, what their nature is, and how they function, how they interact interdependently and so forth, impermanently. And then in meditation, we meditate on non-entityness, non-presumption, not presuming that there's anything to meditate upon. In that case, we may ask, what is it? Is it possible that we can identify the actual view through analytical resting using the reasonings explained in the scriptural tradition? So the reasonings explained in the scriptural tradition are the ones we've seen before, I think last week, the Madhyamaka reasonings of phenomena which must be either single or multiple, and yet you can't find anything that is actually unitary, because everything has parts. And then phenomena, cause and effect, don't actually function, because cause and effect never meet. And to say that something is a result is to propose that something came out of nothing. First there were some causes, and then suddenly there's an additional player. There's like another thing. How did that appear? A result. Something never comes out of nothing. So it is possible that we identify the actual view through analytical resting using the reasonings explained in the scriptural tradition. It is also possible to do this by cutting through misinterpretations. And misinterpretations are usually of two types. Superimposition means presuming more than there is. Superimposition, we place something above. We inflate. We think that phenomena exist. And denial is the opposite. It's undercutting and saying there's nothing. So those are two extreme ways of viewing the situation. It is also possible to do this, meaning bringing the view into meditation By cutting through misinterpretations, superimpositions, and denial using the meditation techniques explained in the esoteric traditions. So the tantric traditions, the various tantric traditions, which are generally summed up into the phases of the development practices, development stage or creation stage practices that involve visualizing deities, visualizing beings, visualizing places and so forth, or syllables, and then the completion stage practice that dissolves everything into fundamental natural emptiness. In actuality, however, we must be certain that all phenomena, what are perceived in our perceivers, are simply appearances of our own mind. And the ultimate abiding mode of our mind has never inherently existed in any way. We can't find anything that isn't our mind because we can't touch it, we can't reach it, we can't identify anything beyond our mind. All we can experience is what's in our mind. The ultimate abiding mode of our mind has never inherently existed in any way. We also can't find our mind. It is not veiled by entities or characteristics. It is free from arising, ceasing, or abiding. It remains beyond being an object for the analytical mind. It is free from identification and is uninterrupted. Something that isn't existent can never be interrupted. The analogy for mind is space, the final frontier. However, as beginners, thank you very much for recognizing that. The correct view is to recognize and determine both our illusion-like experiences and our discernments with subtle mindfulness awareness within our meditative experience. So within our meditative experience, which is founded on the two faculties of mindfulness, focused attention and awareness, alertness. Although Elizabeth uses the term alertness usually. I'm curious. Mindfulness, awareness, interesting. Within our meditative experience. So using mindfulness and awareness in our meditation to recognize and determine the illusion-like experience and the illusion-like quality of our experiences. Not letting those remain simply as objects of theoretical understanding. So normally we think, oh, I breathe. I'm a sentient being. I breathe. I have a body. The body breathes. So I'm meditating on the breath. And we've made all sorts of assumptions there about I and the breath and the ability to have a dualistic relationship between subject and object and so forth. And so with our subtle mindfulness awareness within that experience, we recognize and determine both the illusion-like quality of the body, the breath, and the mind, and our discernments, our experience of those phenomena. Not letting them remain as objects of theoretical understanding, not presuming that our habitual propensities are correct. The Buddha in the Sutra on Not Moving from Dharmata. What a great name. Not moving. Observes, phenomena inherently do not arise, innately do not abide, are free from the extremes of actions and deeds, and are beyond being conceptual and non-conceptual objects. So now we enter into a series of quotes about the unfindable, about the unnameable, about the ungraspable quality of reality of all phenomena and perceivers. the verses that summarize the Prajnaparamita Sutras, which is the early Prajnaparamita Sutra attributed to the Buddha Sanchayagata. Knowing that phenomena lack any nature is the practice of the sublime Prajnaparamita. So knowing that phenomena lack any nature, how long can we rest in that conviction that all phenomena lack nature? The same text says, not conceiving of either non-arising or arising is the practice of sublime Prajnaparamita. So not coming up with some idea of, oh, all phenomena lack nature, and therefore they don't arise. That would be holding a conceptual framework in our mind. That would not be Prajnaparamita. And then the sutra presenting the undifferentiable nature of the Dharmadhatu, another interesting name, sutra. Mind is not physical. It cannot be demonstrated. It does not appear. It is unobstructed and is not cognizable. It does not dwell internally, externally, or in between those two. Thus, it is pure and non-existent. It has nothing to free. Mind has never been imprisoned because it's not existent. It is of the nature of the Dharmadhatu, like space. The text praises to the mother, says, I couldn't find that one, praises to the mother. I don't think I was able to find that one. That's like a famous, very popular text on Mother's Day. So you should try to find that by Mother's Day. Prajnaparamita, inexpressible through speech or thought. There was a footnote about this. It's quoted as various sources, and the ultimate source is a little unfindable, but it's a very famous phrase. And it appears in the Sadhana of Vajrayogini, which
It's also called Praises of Prajnaparamita.
Yeah.
Still couldn't find it?
I think that one is findable. Thank you.
I think that's what this is referring to, according to 390.
The footnote, yeah.
It says it's by Nagarjuna or Rahulabhadra. Why do you do
that? The fundamental treatise by Nagarjuna says, not relinquished, not attained, not annihilated, not permanent, not ceased, not arisen. This is nirvana. The Exalted Lord, which is a great epithet for Atisha, explains, it is profound and free from elaborations. What is luminous and unconditioned, talking about the mind, is unborn, unceasing, primordial purity, never stained by the kleshas, never stained by ignorance, never experienced suffering. The Dharmadhatu, natural nirvana, is without center or end, without middle or extreme, center or fringe. It is seen by the sharp eyes of the intellect, free from concepts, not blurred by dullness or agitation. That's the first quote that has a positive spin to it. It is seen. Wow, that's a little radical. He also says, it is explained that prajna is knowing the emptiness of nature in the context of realizing the non-arising of skandhas, dhatus, and ayatanas. Knowing the emptiness of nature, so emptiness of self-nature, presumably, in the context of experiencing or understanding, realizing that all phenomena, which can be summed up as skandhas, or dhatus, or ayatanas, are not arising. Okay, finally, the way that view is cultivated in meditative experience, equipoise, Generally speaking, meditation is to be undistracted from the view. So if you don't understand the view, then meditation's going to be a little tricky. Rest naturally settled in the view. That was just explained. Rest naturally settled in the view. Naturally, meaning with an uncontrived quality, without intellectual speculative mind operating. So this is the culmination of prajna. Study, reflection, or contemplation, or analysis, and then meditation. All the other objects of meditation and states of attention should be given up without altering or manipulating, diminishing or augmenting, examining or analyzing. Remain naturally settled in a non-meditating mode. So we have a little Mahamudra-ish thing going on here of like not meditating, non-meditating. Meditation is non-meditation. And it's a little bit like Talopa's famous six precepts: do not analyze, think, plan, or anything, but remain at rest without altering, manipulating, diminishing, augmenting, examining, analyzing. Remain naturally settled in a non-meditating mode. And then my favorite sutra, the space-like samadhi sutra, says, with the amrita from the genuine gurus, the amrita is the ambrosia of the gods, the ambrosia that grants limitless life. You will know in your mind to be like space. So the amrita from the genuine guru is a way of referring to the teachings, the ear whisper teachings, the teachings that one gets directly from a genuine guru. And through those, you will know your mind to be like space. To not waver from that state is taught to be samadhi. The sutra of genuine samadhi states, in dharmata, just as it is, so rests mind that is just like it. Mind and dharmata are one and the same non-entity. Experience unhindered by words dawns. I don't know who's experiencing it, but it's a non-verbal experience beyond words. That is called samadhi. In the inexpressible dharmata, so dharmata is similar to dharma dhatu. Dharmata is the nature of true phenomena, or the true nature of phenomena. And dharma dhatu is the element of dharma dhatu. It's the realm of true nature. So rests mind that is just like it. In the inexpressible dharmata, so rests mind that is just like it. So mind rests in itself, which is dharmata. Experience without limitations dawns, and that is called samadhi. The Prajnaparamita in 700 lines, so there's many, many versions of Prajnaparamita sutras, explains not adopting, not holding, not rejecting any phenomena is Prajnaparamita meditation. Not contemplating and not observing anything is Prajnaparamita meditation. The one in 8,000 lines says to meditate on Prajnaparamita means not meditating on any phenomena. It also says to meditate on Prajnaparamita is to meditate upon space. It concludes space is non-conceptual and Prajnaparamita is non-conceptual. The Sutra of Precious Space and Maitreya remark. An interesting implication is that Maitreya has either quoted this sutra or somehow made the same statement. From this, there is nothing to remove. from this meaning, from anything, from our mind, from anything. There's nothing to remove. There's no kleshas. There's no impurity. To this mind, nothing need be added. There's nothing missing. Look truly at what is true. Look truly at what is true. Those who see truly will be free. And the Avatamsaka, famous sutra, well-known sutra, says, those who wish to enter the domain of the victorious ones should train with a space-like attitude. How many of you were into Star Trek when you were kids? See, that's why you're here, because you're into space, the final frontier, space-like attitude. Abandon clinging to concepts, thoughts, and discriminations, and engage this domain with a space-like mind. Not spaced out, not Kevin Spacey, but space-like mind. Maitreya demonstrates in his ornament for the Mahayana Sutras. So this is a text by Maitreya where he takes quotes from zillions of sutras attributed to the Buddha and arranges them thematically. Intelligent ones rest in the Dharma Dhatu, the root of the excellent presentations of the genuine Dharma taught by the sages. Those steadfast in their recognition that all instances of mindfulness are mere conceptuality quickly perfect the ocean of virtues. So we have a first glimmer of a theme that becomes very important later on in the Buddhist tradition of non-mentation or non-mindfulness. Mindfulness is the act of holding in mind a subject-object framework. And while it's very helpful, or more than that, it's essential in order to meditate as a beginner, as an intermediate student, even as an advanced student, we need mindfulness. But at some point, we have to let go of that framework because they're all conceptual. The commentary on Bodhicitta by Nagarjuna says the mind free from reference point rests with the characteristics of space. Meditating on space is described as meditating on emptiness. Letitia, the exalted Lord, explains in the Dharma Dhatu, free from elaborations, rest your mind free from elaborations. These and many other sayings of the Mahasiddhas that contain similar explanations will be presented in the section on Mahamudra, implying that we've sort of merged into the Mahamudra tradition, which will have these very quotes and many others as the heart of its presentation. Finally, the way the view is experienced during post-meditative attainment. So the word attainment is our key to understand that this does not mean everything outside of meditation practice, but it means outside of equipoise when we're able to understand the true nature of reality. Attainment, i.e. attainment. When you experience post-meditative appearances, which are outside of meditative equipoise. In meditative equipoise, it's said that there are no appearances. So as we leave equipoise, we again experience appearances. When you experience those appearances, embrace them with energy or light touch of the mindfulness cultivated during the space-like equipoise described above. Meaning, in the equipoise described above, where we've merged our mind with space, there's nothing to hold on to with our mindfulness. So our mindfulness becomes a sort of non-mindfulness, described here as the light touch of mindfulness. In truth, appearances do not inherently exist, and yet they manifest vividly in their own mode of appearance as if they exist. So all these appearances continuously manifest in their own mode, in the way that appearances are known to manifest, with seeming adherence to cause and effect, and so forth. That is why post-meditative attainment is called illusion-like. So understanding the illusion-like quality of all appearances. This is referred to in many statements, such as the following. The verses that summarizes the Prajnaparamita Sutra explains, those who know the five skandhas to be like illusions and don't take illusions to be one thing and skandhas to be another, as if skandhas were not also illusions, because they are free from the myriad discriminations and experience peace. That is the practice of the sublime Prajnaparamita. That was one of the, this and the next quote, the King of Samadhi Sutra says, like mirages and cities of Gandharvas, illusions and dreams, all characteristics you entertain are empty of any essence. No, all phenomena are this way. After Trungpa Rinpoche died, a gentleman, an amazing teacher named Kenpo Tsultrim Gyamso Rinpoche, who was a sort of mind-challenging combination of a yogi and a scholar, came and visited our community and taught year after year for 13 years, mostly at Carmichael, but also a little bit in Boulder and also in Halifax, and then also in Europe. And he would have us sing songs, mostly Milarepa songs, over and over. But these two verses, he also had us just repeat over and over, like for like an hour, just like over and over repeating these verses. The meaning of illusion-like is as follows. The conceptualization of the appearances that arise to the post-meditative mind with the thought, they're not real, they're illusion-like, is called intellectually fabricated illusion. So if you're like me and you're still in that phase where you have to like say to yourself, oh, you don't exist and you don't exist, you're all illusion like all of you, that is a conceptually fabricated experience, and it's just a presumption that things are illusion like it's like sort of mimicking, like we've heard that they're illusion like and we have faith, which is the starting point, but it's not the real thing. While that may be useful in some phases, so he's saying this may be useful initially in our practice and for quite some time, this way of viewing our reality to lessen attachment and to shift the habit pattern of fixation on things as being real. It is not the point of meditating on all phenomena as being illusion-like. So as long as we're holding a conceptual framework in mind, even if it's the right one, then it's not the true meditation. In that case, we may wonder, how is it done? Please tell me. The horses and elephants that illusionists conjure up can serve as an analogy. And so again, I think we talked about this, how in India and in particular, there were magicians who were very skilled in creating illusory images. Although they have never had the nature or essence of horses and elephants, they undeniably appear as horses and elephants. The perception of the way they appear is the same for both the audience and the illusionist, but in terms of the understanding of the way they actually are, there is one difference. One group believes those to be real horses and elephants, while the other does not. The other is a small group consisting primarily of the magician who creates the illusion, does not believe it. Similarly, in relation to persons and phenomena, it's logical that ordinary beings believe things to be as they appear. Yogins and yoginis, however, know from within that whatever appears is simply an appearance and does not have the nature or essence of that entity. Simply an appearance. So chairs and tables and horses and elephants are simply appearances. They're not actual elephants and horses. What's the difference? Therefore, in the same way that illusionists regard their illusory creations, yogins and yoginis know that ultimately all phenomena lack any nature, and yet conventional appearances simply occur unceasingly. That's the difference. That is said to be the meaning of illusion-like, as is stated in the King of Samadhi Sutra, Samadhi Raja. Illusionists conjure up forms, creating various horses, elephants, and chariots. Those appear despite not existing at all. No, all phenomena are this way. Once you are habituated to yoga, you can mix your meditative equipoise that does not move from dharmata and your post-meditative attainment of seeing things as illusion-like. So, habituated to yoga, presumably, is a reference to samadhi, presumably the samadhi of joint shamatha and vipassana. And then this idea of mixing is a reference to what happens on the path after one experiences genuine, direct, i.e. non-conceptual understanding or vision of the true nature of reality. And that stage happens on the path of seeing. On the path of seeing, one experiences the culmination of the union of shamatha vipassana focused on the true nature of phenomena as being without any essence, without any abiding nature, beyond the conceptual presumption of superimposition and denial. And that experience happens in meditative equipoise and is very short experience, relatively. I mean, it might go on for hours or days or a week. One could stay in meditative equipoise, but eventually one comes out of meditative equipoise, and then phenomena appear once again to the perceiver, based on the accumulated habit patterns that one has acquired over beginningless aeons, or from beginningless time. And then the path from bhumis, so that's the first bhumi of the bodhisattva bhumis. The path of seeing is the first bhumi. And then you have the 10 bhumis. So the remainder of the path is integrating the post-meditative attainment with the meditative equipoise. And up until the 11th bhumi, up until the sort of completion of the 10th bhumi, those are still separate experiences. The meditative experience is still more profound or ultimate than the post-meditative experience. And then when one experiences the complete enlightenment of a Buddha, there's no difference between meditative equipoise and post-meditation state. It's one continuity. So there's a very long period of time where we wear out the habit pattern of the presumption of appearances appearing to a mind in the post-meditative state. Then everything manifests as the play of dharmata. Free from dualistic perception, you attain the realization of unification. The verses that summarize the Prajnaparamita Sutras says, There is no manipulation of thinking, I am resting evenly, or I am getting up. Why? Because you understand the nature of phenomena. And there's this distinction made in the presentation of the paths and the way the factors cultivated on the path overcome the obstructions to enlightenment, in that they say that the first bhumi, the path of seeing, stage of enlightenment, is called liberation, liberation from the belief in a self, the fixation on a self. And that is overcome by understanding, by wisdom, by intellectual knowledge that culminates in non-conceptual wisdom, understanding, realization. And so that aspect of the path operates by negation, fundamentally, negating what is not true, negating false beliefs. And it's fundamentally the cognitive obscuration, works on the cognitive obscuration. And then the bhumis 2 through 10 is said to be overcoming that which is, it's the phrase is, sorry, the phrase is first, that which is overcome by understanding or reasoning is the ignorance that keeps one from experiencing the path of seeing, that which is overcome by reasoning. And then that which is overcome by the path is the habit tendencies, the habitual tendencies of continuing to experience dualistically, that there's appearances appearing to a mind, phenomena appearing to a perceiver, percepts appearing to a perceiver, is said to be overcome by the path, just by continuing application of wearing away the habit patterns. The habit patterns have been accumulated and acquired for so long that they're incredibly deeply ingrained. And there's this way of dividing the path of the 10 bhumis into two parts. There's bhumis 1 or 1 through 8 or 2 through 8 that are called the impure bhumis, where one is actually still subtly accumulating further habit tendencies, habitual tendencies to experience dualistically in the non-meditative equipoise post-attainment state. One continues to experience appearances to a perceiver. And then at the point of accomplishing the eighth bhumi, one then goes on to what are called the pure bhumis, where one is no longer accumulating any further subtle tendencies, but continues, only unwinds those tendencies, lets go of those tendencies for the remaining bhumis. And that process is said to be very long. So when they look at the length of time of the path in the Mahayana tradition, they say that it takes 3 incalculable aeons. And the first incalculable aeon is how long it takes to get to the path of seeing. And then the second incalculable aeon is to go from the second bhumi, or to go from the path of seeing, the first bhumi, to the eighth bhumi. And then the third incalculable aeon is from the eighth bhumi to Buddhahood. It takes that long to wear off the latent tendencies to experience as if we're experiencing something, as if there's a perceiver and a person. And so his conclusion of this section, having discovered the view for Vipassana, so first discover the view, you know, so it's like, what do we come away with? Of like, how do we practice Vipassana in this tradition? We do it through the three stages of learning, contemplating, and then meditating. And so we learn and we contemplate the view, And we discover the view intellectually through learning and contemplating. And then we bring that intellectual experience into meditation and gradually experience that view non-intellectually in meditation practice. So having discussed, and then it becomes the true view when it's a non-intellectual conceptual experience. Having discovered the view for Vipassana, when you are sustaining it, do the following. Cultivate a stream of mindfulness that is not distracted from that very view. Be watchful, with the alertness that dispels dullness and agitation, the two major obstacles to shamatha, as well as Vipassana. Arouse applied intention right within the view. So there's an active process there. Arouse applied intention within the view, free from dullness and agitation, which is something that wasn't quite described earlier in this chapter, but like give rise to this intention to understand the nature of the view, or bring the view into experience and meditation. Rouse that intention. Rely on equanimity. So that rousing is either a very subtle experience or a short-lived experience, because it has to become equanimous, if that's a word, I don't know. It has to have the nature of equanimity, such that your mind does not apply itself to anything other than that view. With all of those, employ the four types of attention, which is a scheme described in the shamatha section, beginning with forceful attention, and then interrupted attention, and then uninterrupted, and then spontaneous attention, which is a description of our ability to be connected with being present, being with the object. First, it's a forced situation. And gradually we succeed a little bit, and then gradually succeed more, and then finally it becomes a spontaneous experience. With all of those, employ the four types of attention, the attention that is tightly focused on the rest, being aware that they apply equally to shamatha and vipassana. So in Vipassana also, having that same quality of going through stages of applying ourselves to the object. In this case, the object is the view of the true nature of whatever our experience is, whatever we're experiencing, the breath, the body, thoughts, appearances, sense perceptions, and so forth. As the Shravaka Bhumi, which is a text by a Sangha, Maitreya's main disciple, and a text that presents the system of meditation in the Mahayana, from the Mahayana tradition's point of view, most extensively, and has yet to be translated. That completes the explanation of the way to cultivate Vipassana. So, in the last class, I'll pull together other versions, other presentations or explanations of the three main schemes for Vipassana that were presented. And just briefly, if you go back to the beginning of the Vipassana chapter, on page 63, it says, there, broadly speaking, there are three types of Vipassana. And then it says mundane Vipassana, a lesser type of super mundane Vipassana, and a Mahayana or greater super mundane Vipassana. The first is Vipassana that focuses on the aspects of calmness and coarseness of one's absorption state. The middle is the Vipassana that focuses on the four truths, with an emphasis on the refutation of the self of a person. And the latter is the Vipassana to be cultivated here, and as we know, it is focused on the refutation of a self of phenomena, or entity of all phenomena. And then he quotes, The unraveling, the intense sutra, samdhi, and emotion explains there's three types of vipassana, that which arises from characteristics, that which arises from thorough investigation, and that which arises from discernment. And the first is the prajna that engages the characteristics of objects, which is a preparatory phase of vipassana. It analyzes, it discriminates and differentiates the characteristics of our experience, skandhas, ayatanas, and dhatus. The vipassana that arises from thorough investigation is the prajna that understands what was not understood about the abiding state of the view. And here, what was not understood before is the true nature of those phenomena that we have differentiated and discriminated. And then finally, the vipassana that arises from discernment is the prajna that is capable of liberation and is directed towards dharma topics that are well understood. And so the three really include a set of two steps that sort of go hand in hand. And the third, which is first we analyze phenomena in terms of the way they appear, their characteristics, their interdependence, their multiplicity, and so forth. And then we investigate phenomena in terms of their nature. And the third one is doing that with the object of the self of persons and phenomena, which is how we cultivate the prajna capable of liberation, directed toward dharma topics that were very well understood by the first two phases. So in the third one, we don't do discursive analysis. We're just bringing the meaning that we found from the first two steps into our practice over and over again. And that meaning is fundamentally the experience of not finding things to exist in the way that we presume to them to exist, in the way our conceptual mind presumes them to exist. So there's that scheme. On the next page, we have the four types of vipassana. The vipassana that differentiates phenomena is the prajna that focuses on quantitative phenomena. And this is usually translated as the extent of phenomena, the way they appear interdependently through causes and conditions by means of the objects of meditation for purifying behavior. So this is where we use antidotes for anger and attachment and so forth. Because we understand that the way experience happens in a cause and effect way, even though cause and effect don't exist, that's the way phenomena appear to exist. And then the vipassana number two that differentiates thoroughly is the prajna that focuses on qualitative phenomena, usually translated as the nature of phenomena. So we have this phrase, the nature and extent of phenomena. The nature being the way phenomena are, i.e. empty, and the extent being the way they manifest, the way they appear as appearances. And these are said to be the domains of the two types of omniscience. The omniscience, which is the faculty of primordial wisdom of a Buddha, has two domains that it realizes thoroughly. Omniscience realizes the way phenomena are, their true nature, and the way they manifest. And then the third one discerns completely. It's the prajna that differentiates coarse, qualitative, and quantitative objects by means of apprehending characteristics by conceptuality. So three and four are in other places described as subtle versions of one and two. That basically one and two are introductory or coarse meditations on the extent and nature of phenomena, and three and four are the more advanced stages of subtlety of those. The fourth one, the prajna that correctly differentiates subtle qualitative and quantitative objects. So correctly differentiates or understands or investigates the nature and extent in a subtle manner, profoundly. And then we have the six categories, which is an understanding of the way that phenomena and reality, what is their nature, what are their characteristics. And it's this standard list of six, which seems to be a condensation of a list of 10 objects of knowledge in a text by Maitreya, and is not like a progression. It's not like you start with one and go through to six. It seems it's sort of like this covers everything, and some of them are in pairs. So this one is more like once we understand the nature of like selflessness of persons and phenomena, then we apply that to different realms of our world, of our experience, of our understanding, the meaning of words, what an entity, what a thing is. What are the characteristics of phenomena? What are their qualities? What is time? How does time work? And reasonings. And these terms are vague, and we need to, I'll provide a number of sources that flesh these out, and we can look at these in the last class, so we'll go through those a little more. And we'll also look at Trungpa Rinpoche's presentation of the same. But now we get a few minutes to dive into the next chapter, Removing Doubts. Which is chapter 4, starts on page 87, and it has four parts, starting with the distinctions between analytical meditation and resting meditation. Here, he's going to talk about, there's some stereotypes about meditation that he's found to be inaccurate in limiting ways of understanding the situation of these different types of meditation. He's going to try to clear them up. And so he's writing in the 15th century. And if you're in the world of Shambhala or Trungpa Rinpoche, you will have seen him make reference to these types of meditation. Resting meditation and analytical meditation. And he presents a clear preference for resting meditation, and sort of disses the analytical meditation in one place. However, he then goes on in other talks to present analytical meditation. So he was a complicated presenter. You can't like simplify his presentation. Something that the meditation of panditas are scholars, professors, is only analytical meditation, and that the meditation of kusalis are yogis, is only resting meditation. Similarly, others think that the only thing scholars ever do is all day long they analyze in the context of study and reflection based on the scriptural systems, and all the only thing that kusalis do is rest in equipoise, referring to esoteric instructions all day long. This is not how it is. Scholars need the resting meditation of remaining in equipoise with the object of meditation, and kusalis need the analytical meditation that cuts through misinterpretations, superimpositions, and denials in the context of the view. In the context of the view, those who don't use both analysis and resting will have difficulty discovering the true object of meditation, because the view that is sought through critical investigation alone is an intellectually created view, and the view that only involves resting stays at the level of a mental experience. That sentence is a very important sentence. It's sort of like a synthesis, a synthetic way of looking at these two traditions as being complementary and both necessary, because both of them, if pursued exclusively, have limitations, severe limitations. We may wonder, how are analytical meditation and resting meditation defined? What are their differences? The terms analytical and resting are designated from their perspective of what they emphasize. So he's saying they're not like exclusive categories where there's a hard line between them. It's a matter of emphasis. Like within the tradition of resting style meditation, there's an emphasis on direct experience. And within the system of the Panditas, there's an emphasis on study, but not to the exclusion, neither to the exclusion of the other. Analytical meditation refers to the meditative process that uses inferential cognition as its path, meaning intellectual analysis. Inferential cognition, and primarily determines the view by relying on critical investigation using scriptures and reasonings. Resting meditation, on the other hand, refers to the meditative process that uses direct cognition as its path and primarily determines the view through remaining in equipoise with suchness. The former is the meditation process that is based on the texts of the noble Asanga and the protector Nagarjuna. So he's saying both of the two, who are known as the two chariots of the Mahayana tradition, Nagarjuna and Asanga, both of them present a system that is focused on analytical meditation, or emphasizes, I should say. The latter, the resting meditation, is the meditative process transmitted from the great Brahman, Saraha. He was of the Brahman class, and that's how he's referred to. His main student, the Lord Shawaripa, and others, in which remaining in equipoise with the actual abiding state is emphasized. The view that is discovered through either approach must be the same in terms of the abiding state, emptiness. The view, which is the object of meditation, is the view, and it has to be the same, emptiness. As good Tsongpa, student of, Kampopa, teaches the analytical meditation of Panditas and the resting meditation of Kusalis have the same final destination, but the Kusali approach is faster, which is why that's what is primarily presented. The Pandita approach takes a really long time to get their whole system down, understand it. It is only just possible to realize the correct view by relying on the critical investigation of scriptures and reasonings. Because such critical investigation is conceptual analysis that involves terms and reference, and Dharmakirti, who was the second of two gentlemen who championed the tradition of logical reasoning in the Buddhist tradition, has explained that that cannot determine the view as a direct cognition. Direct cognition means non-conceptual. So it is only, going back to the beginning of that sentence, it is only just possible to realize the correct view by relying on the critical investigation. It's a little bit of a confusing sentence. Continuing on, there are numerous accounts about how the majority of great panditas and siddhas belonging to the two great chariot systems were liberated through relying on esoteric instructions such as those found in secret mantra. The 84 Mahasiddhas and all of the great masters in the Kagyu Nyingma tradition basically were all liberated by the system that emphasizes resting meditation, which is why that's what's presented primarily to us in terms of emphasis. In particular, there are stories of many great panditas, including Naropa and Maitripa, who were unable to achieve liberation through listening and reflection, the first two prajnas, that relied upon scriptures and reasonings, but were liberated through the esoteric instructions on the ultimate essence. It seems that most Mahasiddhas of India and Tibet have been liberated solely by relying upon esoteric instructions. So some have relied on both, and many have relied exclusively on the esoteric instructions of the tantric system of meditation. That being so, those who say that generally the view cannot be realized without relying on scriptures and reasonings. So if you say that the view cannot be realized without scriptures and reasonings, then how come there's all these great Mahasiddhas that did it? And that specifically, the true view cannot be realized without relying on the Madhyamaka reasonings of the father Nagarjuna and his son Aryadeva. So those two are affectionately referred to as father and son, are simply espousing their own idiosyncratic ideas. It's sort of absurd to say that, because then anybody born beforehand can't have ascertained the view and attained liberation. Sort of like what goes on in the Christian tradition of where they say that anybody born between Jesus, the best they can do is purgatory, right? Because you can only achieve heaven by accepting Jesus. And if you never knew about Jesus, then sorry, Charlie. They are quite wrong. were they right, it would mean that the true view was not realized prior to Nagarjuna's and his son's composition of their treatises included in the collection of reasonings, and that most Buddhist bodhisattvas and Indian and Tibetan siddhas did not realize the true view because they didn't focus on those texts. Furthermore, broadly speaking, if we look at this from the perspective of the use of the terms analysis and resting, meditations that involve critical investigation must be considered analytical meditation. And meditations during which we settle into the natural state and rest must be resting meditations. Other meanings of the words analysis and resting would be difficult to explain or justify because that's what they're called, analysis and resting. That being so, all meditations involving critical and intelligent critical investigation, beginning with the meditation on the difficulties of acquiring the leisures and opportunities, i.e. precious human birth, the first of the four reminders in the tantric or esoteric tradition, up through determining the two absences of self-entity of persons and phenomena, must be analytical meditation. All types of resting, evenly on the object of meditation, that is the subject of analysis with one point in mindfulness and alertness, must be resting meditation. So he's showing the absurdity of that, of a classification that takes a simplistic approach, I believe. These meditations, like the precious human birth and karma and sufferings of samsara and so forth, they're analytical meditations. And then shamatha, resting the mind on the object, is a resting meditation, has that aspect of it. But it can also be a vipassana meditation where you rest the mind on the view, and that can be a resting meditation. So he's getting to this point of mixing up what we normally think is that resting is shamatha and analytical is vipassana. And he's trying to mess with us on that. On the other hand, some think that when they analyze, they are unable to rest because they must analyze conceptually. And when they rest, they cannot analyze because they must settle non-conceptually. So simplistically, we think these are mutually exclusive. They regard analysis and resting as incompatible. They are wrong for many reasons. The first stages of meditation by Kamala Shil explains that prajna examines within a state of shamatha, and that the prajna of equipoise and analyzes. So the first is that prajna examines within a state of shamatha. So there's analysis in resting. And then there's that the prajna of equipoise analyzes. So within a resting meditation, which is equipoise, there's analysis. Vasubandhu's explanation of the ornament of Mahayana Sutra says that there is vipassana with both conceptuality and analysis, vipassana with no conceptuality but with analysis. That's the most interesting one. Vipassana without conceptuality but analysis. How can you have analysis without conceptuality? That's a really cool one. And there's also vipassana with neither of those two. Also, vipassana analysis is often used to ensure that the state of resting does not slip away. And he's talking about the function of sheshan, or samprajanya, alertness in shamatha practice. That is a sort of vipassana-like faculty that restores, strengthens, and maintains our mindfulness. For example, during shamatha, the arousing of alertness is examination occurring within a resting state. The roles of analytical and resting meditation, shamatha, vipassana, let's see. Well, I guess we have to pause there. 89. That was exactly where we were supposed to go to, actually. So we made it all the way through. So then next week, we will not have any doubts. All of our doubts will have been removed. Oh my God, there's a lot to go through. 109, that's 20 pages next week. Okay, so next week will be that chapter. And then the following week will be looking at other sources on Vipassana. Deal? And then I was proposing that we continue on with this book for the next course. Does anybody second that opinion? All right. Might as well. We got this momentum. Might as well keep going, right? Or, you know, we could look at some Nagarjuna or some Abhidharma or Pramana logic. No?
Definitely, I think she said it in the beginning. This is something you want to read slowly, like read a paragraph or two, meditate, and read more. And, yeah. So it's better that we go through it slowly.
Yeah, it's a complicated text. Any final comments, suggestions, questions before we dedicate and close? Mary Beth.
I was just reminded of that moment in second grade when I asked Miss Pennington about the people on the island who'd never heard of Jesus. Like, what happened to them? Second grade.
Good for you. And you were like, you figured it out. It's like, this system is crazy. What did Miss, what was her name? Sister Pennington. So how many Hail Marys did you have to do for that?
She was not a sister. She was kind, and she said that they would be okay. That they would be okay.
They'll be okay anyway. That's great. Good for you, second grade. Okay, here we go. Dedication. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may defeat the enemy of wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings by the confidence of the golden sun of the great east. May the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy rather profound, brilliant glory. Thank you, everyone. Nice to see you, or at least see your names, some of you.
Thank you, Dad.
Be well. Take care. See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.